This is What's Happening Now. I am Sam Hampson, and we start this week with a riddle, a teaser, a conundrum. Choose your fighter, choose your favourite. Gun to your head if you had to pick one. Dick or tax?
The investigation into a sexting scam at the heart of Westminster has widened further tonight. Two police forces are now involved, and another MP, Luke Evans, has said he was targeted via WhatsApp. It follows the senior Conservative William Ragg's admission that he'd handed out his colleagues' phone numbers to someone he'd met on a gay dating app. He said he was acting out of fear that he could be compromised using intimate photos that he had shared.
Labour's Angela Rayner and a council house she bought in Stockport. This house now the subject of an escalating row about whether she paid the correct tax when she sold it before becoming an MP. It's claimed that she actually lived a mile away at the home of her then husband Mark Rayner and their children. She says a tax advisor gave her the all clear.
It's a tale of two scandals this week, with one Conservative compromising himself and others by diving headfirst into a honey trap, and one senior Labour figure being accused of underpaying tax at a time the Labour Party as a whole are saying, you know what we're going to do? We're going to make sure people pay their taxes. In some ways, it feels like neither story is quite breaking out from the media into the wider world. And you know why that is? It's because, honestly, we're all so tired. Now, Conservative MP William Ragg willfully got his willy out, becoming the most problematic Member of Parliament since Johnson was Prime Minister. And like Boris, Ragg has had to pull out of his position after shafting his colleagues. A salacious and significant story, to be sure, while Angela Rayner, on the other hand, faces questions about possibly underpaying tax on the sale of a home in 2015. Nominations of a main residence, the value of enhancements, lots of things make a difference here. So forgive me if I get technical. I used to work in tax, but this is what is known as really fucking boring. What matters is that Ragg is on his way out, not just of powerful positions on Conservative and House of Commons committees, but as an MP in general. And Rayner, most likely, is on the way in, probably, as the poll suggests, to one of the most prominent positions in politics, Deputy Prime Minister. And both, in their own way, say a lot about what matters to the parties right now. To talk about that and more, a man who has probably clicked every link on the internet and who I suspect has already done next year's tax return, James O'Malley. James O'Malley. James, how's your week?
Whatcha? No, I have actually already done my tax return for this year. I was straight on April the 6th.
Yeah, we're recording this on the 10th of April. So it will be within the first 4 days of the tax year, you've done it. That doesn't shock me at all.
I just can't wait. I was counting down till midnight on, you know, ready to go.
What are you going to do for the rest of the year now? There's nothing left to go. You've had all the fun too soon.
Well, now I'm just going to sit here looking smug, and especially when January rolls around and everyone's looking slightly panicked and slightly harried. I'm going to be just, you know, the smuggest motherfucker alive. I'm just going to... What, tax return? Already done it.
Already done it. Do you know a piece of secret insider knowledge that I learned when I worked in tax? Mm. Was it if you do your tax returns early, if you get it in April, you are less likely to be investigated, because they're still working through last year's and the late ones from January. Then the way they skim and do it, someone who produced the papers was like, yeah, if you put it in April, you are significantly less likely to be investigated. So good for you. You'll hide all your illegal dealings. James, we are talking
good
about...
Good advice for any tax avoiders listening.
Yeah, that's probably not what we should be doing on the podcast, but tune in to Tax Evasion with Sam and James. Now, James, this week we're talking political polling mainly, and in that we've just talked about two of the big scandals that are affecting parties this week, and they're both nervous because in election year, polling matters. Polling really takes up the attention. Can you start by, I suppose, explaining polling a little bit, but also talk us through what's happening with William Ragg?
Yeah, so William Ragg, he's constantly referred to in the media as a senior Tory MP. That annoys me because he's 6 months younger than me, and I don't like that there are, quote, senior Tory MPs who are younger than me, because that makes me feel extremely old. Although, to be fair, he's now no longer a Tory MP. He was forced to, he voluntarily resigns the whip from the Tory party. He's no longer a Conservative because he was caught up in a so-called honey trap scandal. He was on, I think it was Grindr, the dating app, and got into an interaction with someone who turned out to be after trying to extract information from him. They weren't looking for romance. They were just looking for dirt on MPs. And he fell victim to this scam.
Is your understanding that Grindr is a romantic interaction app or a dirt app? It's different things to different people, I guess.
maybe so, but I mean, well, it's interesting. So he's not the only one. In Westminster, apparently loads of people closely involved with Parliament, so MPs, staffers, journalists and so on, have all been targeted by this same sort of scam. But he seems to have really fallen for it and given away details from other MPs, like their phone numbers and so on. And that's what's got him into basically loads of trouble.
Because he didn't just interact, he shared intimate pictures, is my understanding, of himself, I think. And then the scammers said, give us the contact details of other people. All these photos come out everywhere. That's broadly right.
Basically, I think you can separate the scandal into two different parts, which is one, which is the sort of salacious side of things, which people would view as a personal thing. But the problem is he's basically given up information which is sensitive, which is details and contact details for his parliamentary colleagues. And everyone's been pointing to, you know, that MPs have been murdered in very recent memory. So you want to be very careful about who you give information out to. And if you're there sharing it on an app because you're being blackmailed, even if you can sympathise with someone for being blackmailed and for being a victim of a big scam, you can be a bit grumpy with him and sympathetic at the same time, I think.
He was not just an old man, James, but a senior Tory, because he was deputy chair of the 1922 committee and held senior positions and was in position of responsibility. But he also said, I think last year, that he wasn't going to stand at the next election. So he's still got power and influence, not got a political future. So the stakes are a little bit different for him.
Yeah, I think he said he was going to stand down probably because he was looking at the polls and realised his seat is absolutely doomed. But even if that's the case, even if that's a sort of mitigating circumstance, he's still a member of parliament. He still needs to uphold the standards we expect of our politicians, at least until he loses his seat or, in this case, resigns.
Yeah, and on the other side, Angela Rayner's getting scrutiny, mainly from the Mail, it feels like. But it's a legitimate question. She's been challenged on her tax affairs.
Yeah, I was hoping you could explain this to me, Sam, because the strange thing about this podcast, right? I'm contractually the boring one. You're the fun one. But you have a backstory working in tax, which I would have thought that would make you the boring one. But you understand tax and how it all works. So what is going on? Because there's a lot of sort of smoke and mirrors and a lot of sort of people going, oh, sounds bad, and a lot of innuendo. But I don't really understand it because it sounds wildly complicated.
It really does risk ruining my reputation as the fun one on here and our whole ambition of making a fun podcast if we just talk about tax. But you know what? We're going to... So... Long story short, with Angela Rayner, she sold a house in 2015 that she'd previously lived in. Her husband had a separate address. And there's basically a situation where you don't have to pay capital gains tax on making a gain on the house if it's your main residence. Now, there's not to get into all the technicalities about where the main residence counts off, but if you're married, it's different than if you're single. It is just about the partnership. There's a few versions here, right? We don't know all the numbers, don't know all the facts. Not even just to get into the actual numbers of itself. You can do repair, you can do enhancements and improve the property. There's lots of versions. What's at stake, it seems most likely, is at most, I've seen estimates about £3,000-£4,000. What's awkward for Labour, I think, is not really the technicalities of tax, but they've just launched their big tax strategy and saying, hey, look, we need to crack down on tax avoiders. So that makes it politically more difficult than I think technically, because the numbers, you know, a couple of £1,000 is significant, but it's more politically embarrassing than actually the numbers are harder to explain. And that's not good for Keir, right, James? That's some, in political terms, that's tricky.
Yeah, so obviously we don't know the specific circumstances with regard to Angela Rayner's situation. My understanding is that's still being investigated, so we'll have to wait and see what happens there. Ultimately, though, there are sort of tax problems for Labour, because basically one of the big storylines in politics over the last few weeks has been Labour coming out and saying they're going to crack down on tax avoiders because they reckon they can raise all of this extra money and then spend it on improving public services. So I guess it is a bit awkward if they're saying we're going to stop tax avoiding and bring in those extra cash, and if their deputy leader is dogged by allegations that she's been avoiding tax.
Right, because we're talking about polling today. We're talking about being able to read the future, talking about ratings. For a long time now, the polls say that Labour are more likely to win the next election than Tories. We're talking about these two scandals. Rag is still in a position of influence and shouldn't be giving out these numbers. But what are the stakes for him? He's sat there, he's doing fine. There's nothing else happening. Angela Rayner in Labour. Surely this is a chance to really show, I guess, their moral backbone and to really be brave about things. But both seem... Sunak's had some criticism this week for not sacking Rag and saying not taking the whip away because he doesn't want a by-election. It seems like they're almost both frozen with fear that their reputation is going to take a knock. And in that, neither of them are achieving anything.
Yeah, I think the boring reality is, at the moment, politics is pretty static. It's pretty boring because, like you say, everyone's too cautious. We're waiting for the election. The Tories, Rishi Sunak is basically too weak to do anything. So he's paralysed by his party, because if he was to try and make any big bets or, say, come out with a big policy that could change the game or something, half his party would hate him because they'd be going in the wrong direction. They'd say he was going in the wrong direction. Whereas Labour are too scared to do anything because they're ahead. Why do anything big or risky when you can just sit on your ass and walk into Downing Street if nothing else changes?
And they look pretty weak. It looks pretty weak. Rachel Reeves turning around and saying, oh, I've known Angela a long time. She's my friend. She shouldn't have to answer these questions. Sorry, I think she probably should have to answer these questions. And especially if you've got a big poll lead, take a gamble on standing for something, no?
It does seem like the sort of situation where they could do something. Do you remember when there was so-called beer gates? It was around just at the end of the pandemic when there was a whole thing about the police investigating Keir Starmer over allegedly drinking a beer and socialising during lockdown. And this story is very similar to the Rayner one, actually, in that it sort of originated in the right-wing press who were doing it to try and unsettle Labour. And Keir Starmer, before the police had made any decisions about whether he'd broken any rules or anything, he came out and said, if it's found out I've broken the rules, I will resign. And it was this big gamble, but it worked out for him because he was found that he was completely fine and he came out looking stronger because he said that beforehand. So I wonder if there's a political opportunity here for Angela Rayner to say, if it is found that I've done anything wrong, I will resign. And then if she turns out she is fine, she comes out of that looking whiter than white.
We've talked about this before, haven't we? That I wouldn't talk about it on local news. We talked about it on other things that we want difficult questions being asked by the media and different. We want the country to stand for something. That if the right-wing press, even with an agenda, ask a difficult question, that's good for the left-wing politicians to be able to answer those. And they shouldn't just turn around and go, we're not answering that. There's nothing to answer. And same as Sunak should answer questions, difficult questions about what the Guardian want to hear about, or, I don't know, the Morning Star or whoever. It should be that the press are able to ask tough questions and it's not just, no, thank you, we don't need to answer that.
In the same sense, yeah, if the Tories are making good points about this, then Labour should respond treating it seriously rather than try to laugh it off.
We're saying that there's not much in my former life of a taxman, that there's not a huge amount of tax at stake. It's not a big tax story because everyone, you know, quite technical rules and people can make mistakes and that's fine. But if you're standing there as a party to say we're going to crack down on a reputation basis and then aren't willing to have your reputation challenged, it's hard. Anyway, we're talking polls this week, aren't we, James? And what do polls mean to politicians? Let's give a quick summary. We're talking Ben Walker later in the episode. But for anyone who's not familiar with political polls, how would you sum them up?
Yeah, so if you've not looked at a political poll recently, then don't worry, because they've been the same for the past sort of 18 months now, which is Labour have a fairly significant lead. So it's a really big, it's a really interesting situation and a big turnaround. So remember the 2019 election? It was like an absolute disaster for Labour. For a year coming out of the pandemic, Boris looked like he was unassailable, like he was this titan who was going to lead for 10 years. I remember there was a famous headline on the Times that was like, Boris is planning his 10 years in power or something like that. But now everything's changed completely and Labour have this sort of 20-point lead, which if you translate it to how the House of Commons might look after the next election, it puts Labour on a silly number of seats, like upwards of 400, 450, if the numbers do translate in that exact way. And then it could put the Tories on less than 100 seats, which would be their most disastrous result possibly ever, certainly, as far as I can remember.
Giddy at that prospect, James.
Yeah, sorry. I, as a neutral observer, I'm obviously thinking that's an interesting set of numbers, not, oh, I can't wait. but yeah, so Labour have this sort of seemingly impenetrable lead because basically since 2019, the big changes in the polling lead has been basically Partygate. When that happened, when Boris resigned, partially because of the whole party stuff, that was one of the turning points. And then the other one was your friend, Liz Truss, taking power. and screwing with the economy and having the disastrous mini budget. And that's basically, and people have thought, well, who can I vote for if the Tories are this terribly incompetent? So they thought, well, this Keir Starmer chap, he seems broadly sensible. And that's basically put the polls now solidly in Labour's favour, to the point where I think if you ask anyone in Westminster who's going to win the next election, they would say with literally about 99% certainty it's going to be Labour.
We'll see. And later today, we're talking to Ben Walker, co-founder of BritInElect, to go into polls in a little bit more detail. But for now, let's also hear from our other resident experts, Ben Lovell and Emmy Files.
Hi, Emmy.
Hiya, Ben.
So, Emmy, polling. What do you know?
I know loads about polls.
Yeah? Go on.
You know, curtain polls, they're good. Pole dancing, very popular. Oh, Pope John Paul II, he was a pole.
Right. I think the polling on today's show might be a bit more political.
No, then. Do you?
Yeah, loads.
Go on, then.
Doesn't matter. Maybe we should just let Sam and James tell us.
Okay, cool.
Wait, didn't you used to work for Parliament?
Anyway. Ooh, let's hear the show.
So, insight as ever there from the geniuses that are Ben and Emmy. Before we get onto some more polling, James, let's talk about what else is happening now. So yeah, James, first my story this week, kind of a story about stories, really. Mm. We've got into journalistic navel gazing a little bit. We did local news last week. We're talking about right and left wing press today. There's a story that is rumbling on this week of Joe Lycett, the comedian, is promoting and getting ready for the launch of his new series of his series, Late Night Lycett, on Channel 4 this Friday, probably the day this episode comes out. Now, Joe is pretty amazing comedian, done some really creative, interesting, provocative stunts over the last couple of years. And this week, he's revealed that he's put some fake stories in the press. He's had some success of being silly, nonsensical stories in the hole, I think, as he puts it, or pushing out space that could have otherwise been used for divisive and polarizing stories. We're yet to find out what these stories are. There's some guesses going around, and there's a hashtag is it Joe? Some of the sillier stories. And we'll find out on Friday on the first episode of his series. James, as a journalist, how do you feel about planting fake news to fight fake news?
Yeah, so I feel very conflicted about this because on the one hand, as a journalist myself, I'm not a massive fan of literally deliberately fake news and trying to add basically more nonsense into the information ecosystem because there's already enough nonsense on the internet without someone deliberately adding more in there. But I do think this is a sort of really interesting experiment because it shows a little bit about how the sausage is made when it comes to news, and it shows the pressures on journalists because you get these stories, and we don't know what they're going to be. One of the stories, for example, is rumoured to be the story you may have seen a few weeks ago about Alan Titchmarsh's trousers being censored by North Korea, though I actually understand that story is correct. But it's going to be those sorts of stories, I imagine, that Joe Lycett has planted, unless he's the one behind the Angela Rayner mortgage story, which will be a funny twist.
A load of nonsense, but serious tax story, yeah.
But I can sort of understand how these stories would get published in the mainstream media because if you're a journalist working today, it's not as glamorous as it once was. In the olden days when there was print newspapers and stuff like that, you talk to an old journalist and they'll tell you stories about, oh, I wrote my 200 words for the print newspaper and then spent the day in the pub. But today, if you're a journalist, you're working really intensely. If you're working for an outlet like The Independent or just any of these places that churn out stories, you're going to be asked to do 5 or 6 stories a day. You barely have time to stop for a lunch or to stop for a snack between writing stuff. So anything you can grab onto, which sounds vaguely interesting, vaguely like something someone will click on, is going to get written up and you won't have time to necessarily scrutinize that. And arguably, there's also an incentive to sort of half believe it because you think, oh, that's such a good story. It's too good to fact check because you want to put it out there because again, we don't know exactly what Joe Lycett's stories are, but they're going to be of that sort of nature, I think. So I think there is a sort of vulnerability there.
I feel like you're arguing for and against this, James, that it's pushing out stories, but There should be more fact-checking, right? The point he's talking about, he's talking about divisive news that pushes apart and silly stories that we get talking is a good thing for society and getting people chatting about the news. But it also makes the point that journalists should be like checking the stories they're putting out there and just sending off, because otherwise it's just passing on press releases, right? It's not journalism, it's just, you know, platforming.
Yeah, a great phrase for this, I think it was coined by Nick Davis, the old Guardian journalist, calls it churnalism. Because all you're doing is just churning stuff. You're taking press releases that have been sent to you. You're taking tweets from celebrities and just and turning them into news stories out of nothing. Reach PLC, who are the company who own the Mirror, I think are the masters of this. They own all the local newspapers as well. And I think I might have ranted about them on the show before.
Yeah, maybe.
But because they're so driven around, basically, they need to get the traffic up on their website so people see the advertising. And they're so mercenary in doing this. They will take a flicker of anything. So I really hate it when you see it. You'll go onto Facebook and you'll see the headline of a story that's being shared that's like BBC breakfast presenter slammed by his colleague or something like that. And then you'll click on the story and it'll be like the presenter made a joke about the other presenter on the telly this morning or something. And it massively overhypes it. And in that way, that basically does, I think, become bullshit. But like you say, I think as sort of information consumers, we need to also train ourselves. The only solution to this sort of nonsense is, because there's going to be just nonsense out there, whether it's from journalists or whether it's just from other people posting nonsense, the only real defense we've got is to train ourselves to be skeptical. Because if the journalists aren't going to have time to fact check and there's just people pumping out nonsense deliberately anyway, we need to sort of approach things as, when we see a story that sounds too good to be true, think to ourselves, maybe it is, maybe I should look into this. Because we also will now, thanks to the internet, have the tools to actually investigate things for ourselves and figure them out. I guess my big takeaway from this is it's a good reminder to be skeptical.
Yeah, that's where we're coming down on this. This is our final verdict. Is old grandfather Joe Lycett is teaching us all a valuable life lesson, which is don't believe the news or do believe the news or just have your own critical thinking. So the journalist James Ball wrote a really interesting book a couple of years ago. I think it was Post-Truth, How Bullshit Conquered the World. Mm. Yeah, interesting read. Yeah, good reminder that bullshit can be fun. Enjoy it, but don't always believe it. But that is not the biggest story of the week, James. The biggest story of the week you're bringing to the table. Tell us all.
Yeah, I'm proud. This is almost like hometown pride. A very exciting story this week as the winner of the best truck stop in Europe has been crowned. And it's the Red Lion truck stop off the A4500 near Northampton. Apparently 40% of truckers in this poll said it was their favourite truck stop. I grew up relatively close to Northampton, so I feel a swell of pride at this because I find sort of truck stops and motorway service areas, and this is going to shock you, weirdly fascinating.
Sorry, I don't know how big our trucker audience is in our listenership, but it's a cool, I thought 40% is a decisive result.
They put it down to all their sort of community spirit, which I guess is what you want if you're slogging away lonely on the road, because being a trucker, it's a really hard job. So I guess if you're going to stop, you want to stop somewhere nice.
You say that so sincerely, like you did it for years.
Yeah, back in my trucking days. Though saying that, I have actually been to what is the world's largest truck stop in Iowa. It's called Iowa 80, and it's massive. It's like the motorway service area of your dreams. There are quick service restaurants. There are toilets. There's an enormous shop where you can buy, and because it was America, it had loads of weird things you could buy in it. T-shirts that supported gun rights and flip-flops shaped like fish.
I have an issue with you saying that I have a truck stop of my dreams, but then you build it as it's got a shop and it's got toilets. So I feel like I'd dream a bit bigger if I was going to dream of a truck stop.
The most interesting thing was it even has a built-in chapel, so that if you're trucking along, you can pop in, get a quick prayer, and then get back on the road.
Okay.
And there was a whole shop at the back as well where truckers could go and buy like custom things to put on their truck, like LEDs and metal signs and this sort of thing. It was extraordinary.
Were you lost? Like, how did you end up there?
Because we were going on holiday to Iowa to go to the Iowa caucus to watch the American election stuff happen.
Surely, it's like, what? So you went to watch a political event and you went, I know, while we're here, let's stop into the truck stop.
Yeah, I persuaded my partner, who again is a human woman, to go on holiday to Iowa in January to watch American politicians give speeches in small halls and things. And on the way, we stopped at a truck stop which we enjoyed so much, and this is absolutely true, we both bought t-shirts saying Iowa 80 on them.
I love that you tricked her into a holiday, being like, no, it'll be lovely, we'll go to the Iowa caucus, and then last minute revealed, oh no, it's a big ruse, we're going to the truck stop. Are you allowed in even without a truck?
Yeah, this was a car and a truck stop, because I guess America does things slightly differently to how we do things in Britain. But yeah, it was a very romantic trip.
Was it? Okay. If your partner has an appetite for more, if that has just got her going and wants more in her life, then head to Northampton to the A4500 and visit this very popular truck.
Already booked into the motel.
So James, our main topic we're talking about this week is political polling. And look, we wanted to talk about this because it seems to pop up in the news quite regularly. And in an election year, it feels like it's only going to become more of a thing that we keep hearing about. Now, my view on polls is both geeky and interested and going, oh, that's a couple of percentage points there, a couple of percentage points there. That's interesting. But also kind of annoyed because they're so prominent that it feels like they're really held up as a measure of success, and that politicians, we talked earlier about Labour living in fear of losing poll points and Conservatives chasing poll point gains, waiting for, I don't know, some big event that they can capitalise on. It feels like it's almost a driving force of politics rather than actually getting stuff done. How true is that?
Mm. I think you're right, because the trouble with polling is, on the one level, it is silly nonsense about an election that's not happened yet. But on the other hand, it does actually matter, and it does actually affect politics, because it frames how politicians think about things. Every politician wants to be re-elected or wants their party to win. And if you look at how the polls go up or down, it does affect the mood of Westminster. The reason at the moment the Conservative Party is tearing itself apart and the reason Labour are flying high is because they've got the polls which tell them that Labour are almost certainly going to win the next election. And that in turn is informing almost everything everyone does. So there's Conservative MPs who are standing down in droves because they know they haven't got a chance at the next election. In the same way, there's loads of corporate interest and everyone started paying attention to what Labour are doing because the polls say that. And I don't necessarily think that's a bad thing, because if polls are measuring public opinion and where we are and where we're at as a nation and just reflecting that at the politicians, that can actually be quite a useful thing of informing them about what we actually want, because otherwise, if they're just going on the last election, that would be a wildly different political program anyway.
But is it not a problem that the polls are saying what we want, and the polls say often that people want an election, and Rishi Sunak and the Conservatives are not listening to that poll, and it's just, we talked about scandals at the top of the show, and it's just keeping us in this kind of holding pattern of waiting for something to come along that might change things for the Conservatives, and then they have to hold an election. What's the point in the polls that they go, do you know what? Maybe the goose is cooked. Maybe we need to have an election.
That's the thing. I think the irony is, though the polls are saying basically Britain is desperate for an election, it's also the polls that are stopping the election from happening, because obviously Rishi now knows that if one is called, he's going to lose. And there's a really, I think it's really fun how we can always tell who's going to lose or who's not doing well, because they'll always say, oh, well, the only poll that matters is the one on the general election, or is the one on election day, because that's basically code for, I know we're doing disastrously and it's going to be a disaster. But now Rishi knows, basically, he's got to hang on as long as he can.
What we need to do is we just all need to say, if any pollster rings, you say, I'm going to vote Conservative, wink, and then they'll put it on the poll. The polls will say a big swing and they'll go, we'll call an election. So I'm not saying advocating lying to polls, but maybe just the gentle mislead.
That's what everyone said we should have done after the last budget or autumn statement. We should have all gone, great budget, Jeremy. Nudge him into rolling the dice, but alas, I don't think we could coordinate 60 million people to do that.
No, well, we've both got our thoughts on polling, haven't we? But we, for this week, have spoken to Ben Walker. James, tell us about Ben and what he does.
Yeah, so Ben Walker is the brains behind Britain Elects. So Britain Elects, they're not a pollster themselves, but they're an organisation which is currently owned by the New Statesman, which they actually look at the polls and collect all this data together and analyse it. He's basically, if you've heard of Nate Silver, the American sort of polling guru who does a similar sort of thing in America, he's a bit like that. So Ben takes all the polls in and he's built an election model, which is basically a mathematical way of taking in all these hundreds of different polls over the time and using them to work out in a more sort of rigorous way who's more likely to win. So he knows what's going on. If anyone has their ear to the ground in the country, it's probably Ben. So he's well worth listening to.
So we spoke to Ben a couple of weeks ago. So some of this might be a little out of date, but a lot of it's still super relevant. And we spoke to Ben about political polling. Ben, so just to start very broad, political polling, how does it work? Why does it work? Why do we see stories about this so often? And who's looking to do that?
Well, we want to know the future. Who doesn't want to predict the future or try and predict and maybe even profit off it? We hark back to the EU referendum when polling really did at one point move markets. No, it's basically we want to gaze in the crystal ball. We want to tell people what people think. You want to feel comforted that X percent of Britons agree with you on this very niche issue. And it's all about that. And here's the thing with polling. Here's what it can do and here's what it can't do. It can tell you where people, what people believe in on binary choices, binary questions, how you're voting or how you're likely to vote. Although everyone overstates, you know, their willingness to do something. But it's not a sort of nuance sense check of sentiment and feeling. It's not really that. That's not what political opinion polling can necessarily do. It can give you a binary forecast of where opinion stands, but nothing much more than that. But we do like to look into it. We do like to try and have a go, don't we? So, you know, if you ask them how they're going to vote, you give the options, that's fine. You can probably get that. But if you ask them quite loaded questions, like you know, insert a recent tweet that's loaded with emotion or whatever, by and large, more people will want to agree with that than not. And that's the problem with a polling. You've got to really be careful with the questioning. You've got to be neutral. And sometimes it's hard to do that. So yeah, there are limitations. But in historic terms, my God, it's been used to forecast elections or come close to elections. And despite everyone repeatedly pointing to the irregular, I have to say, failures of political opinion polling to forecast election results, by and large, it does get the result close. And that needs to be shouted from the rooftops, in my view, because my job's dependent on it.
So in terms of how we then take, you know, it's obviously a very complex thing, and there is sort of an art to it as well as science, I guess, in terms of working out how to balance things. So say a poll comes out and we see the numbers published in a news story and it says Labour are up so many percent, the Tories are down so many percent. How can we take that information and, as a sort of consumer of information, do something with that? How can I take those numbers and go, ah, and therefore I can know who's going to win the election or what those numbers actually mean? What do I do with those numbers? Are they just help me?
Okay. I'm not your therapist here today, but I'll offer something. In terms of one poll, don't do a single thing with it. Don't do anything with one poll. Wait for a few more before you can necessarily do anything. Because that's the thing, noise. It's not just art. It's not just cute to say at the end of a poll, please bear in mind a margin for error of around 3 to 4 points, sample dependent. It's true, because if things move within certain percentage points, hark back to your days at primary school or high school when you had a science class, and they always said, when you do a test once, how often do you do it? Multiple more times, right? You do it for 2, 3 more times. Polling is exactly like that. So you get one poll, that's one test. You need a few more polls, a few more tests to work out if there has been movement or if there hasn't been. So I would always say, if you see one poll which shows like a 5-point shift or some such, that could come down to multiple things. The sampling could really be naff, and it's not beholden to me to necessarily call individual pollsters out, but sometimes the sampling is a little bit poor quality. And you have a sample oversaturated with high attention voters, and another week for some reason undersaturated. That's a sign of some poor cleaning that does need to be sorted out. And sometimes that can mean quite dramatic headline changes. So to summarize this, wait for a few polls. Don't go for one. And when you do, it's always just, yeah, try and work out the subsamples as well. Subsamples for the uninitiated being, of course, you see the headlines, which is the nationwide sample, i.e. this is what the country thinks. And then you can download some tables, which we in the UK are very proudly all aligned to doing, because in the US, data tables, the spreadsheets, the sort of run-up questions are sometimes hidden behind paywalls. In America, it's ridiculous stuff. In the UK, there's a sort of a gentleman's agreement where we all agree to publish it via the British Polling Council, some sort of rules, even though it's all very informal. And you go into these data tables, these spreadsheets, and you find out, okay, here's what the nation thought. How about men, just men? 500 sample, you can be reasonably confident of how they're feeling. Same with women. What about 18 to 24 year olds? Sometimes the sample's too tiny there. If it's 200, 300, you should really give that a wide margin for error, if not ignore it completely. You can work that out, but I would honestly, when you're analyzing polling, stick to the nationwide samples. Stick to the headlines. Don't delve too deep unless you're looking at multiple polls all at once.
And are there any sorts of big mistakes that you think people often make when they look at political polls? One thing I always think is when you see like politically minded people, they will often see a poll result, or so one party will go up, one party will go down, and then they'll immediately say, well, that's obviously because of this really obscure thing that happened in the news that nobody normal will actually have realised has happened. Are there things like that which people often make mistakes on?
The one thing I hate about polls sometimes is the snap polling after an event. So let's say when Jeremy Hunt will get up to the dispatch box and give his whatever we can call them to the country, there will be some snap polling which will put out to say 70% of Britons have an opinion on it. 60-70% of Britons wouldn't even be aware that just happened. There's this annoying thing that voters are aware of the news that just went on, that by and large, more often than not. Snap polling after a budget, I think, is not particularly useful, unless, of course, it's a controlled sample of people who have paid attention to the budget. It's not representative of the country. It shouldn't be seen as representative of the country. If you want to know what the country thought about a budget, poll them a few days after. And what I think that's the annoying thing about journalism as well. You want a snap reaction. You want me to give a snap take over, here's what the public thought about the budget 12 hours after the budget came out. I'm sorry, the country hasn't really paid attention to it. And we often overstate this. We think people pay attention to the news stories like I, the political junkie, we, the heavy Twitter users, pay attention. Well, no, unfortunately not. Now, another mistake people have, I know I don't want to talk too much, so please do interrupt if I'm saying too much here. But one thing that I really do think gets in my bonnet when people look at polling is this. Let's say Labour they fall 2 points and Reform go up 2 points in a poll. Okay, and you could probably think, you wag your finger very confidently. That's in response to boats. Labour is too lax on immigration. They're losing support to Reform with them. I don't think you can necessarily make that conclusion at all about any poll shift. When we look at polling, when you get those headline numbers, Labour 20 points ahead, Labour 15 points ahead, Labour 11 points ahead, that is of those who are certain to vote, combined with whatever reweighting and modelling the pollster has done as well. That is of people who basically, in football terms, are on the pitch, ready to go out and vote. It doesn't account for the people who've left the pitch out of apathy, indifference, a decision to stop voting altogether. How about this? Go back all the way to December 2021, January 2022. Labour has just started to lead in the polls. The Owen Paterson affair did kick things into gear for Labour. And of course, Partygate just hit the airwaves. Labour was up. Labour was gaining, 5 points in some polls. The Tories were losing 4 or 5 points in others. And I think there was a lot of confidence amongst Labour's activists. But one thing you need to look at when you see those polls is this. That isn't support going from the Tories to Labour, or rather at the time wasn't going from the Tories to Labour. What was happening was that so much of the Tory base was saying to pollsters, I don't really want to vote anymore. I'm not really interested in voting. And when you take a large sample of the old Tory base out of the declared voters, you end up, after reweighting, after remodelling, with a very enlarged, enhanced Labour share of the new pie. And it looks like they gained new support, but they by and large didn't. But 2 years ago, Labour's lead was more Tory fall than Labour rise. Now it's something different. It's something a bit more dramatic now. But I think when you look at polling changes, percentage shifts, always remember, this is of the people on the pitch of declaring to vote. It's not people, you know, all of them. And so when you look to America in November, right now, the polls don't look amazing for Joe Biden. He can still pull it back. But a lot of it is down to Democratic apathy. Remember, the Biden coalition that got him elected was predominantly anti-Trump. It is a coalition of many stripes, of many colours, of many backgrounds, liberal, moderate, and indeed, in some cases, conservative. Let's not forget that. And a hefty chunk of that is pretty apathetic with Biden. They're not exactly bothered. And Biden's challenge is to rally them again. Long-winded answer over. Thank you.
Rishi Sunak used the phrase, the will of the British people, when he was talking about stopping the boats going to the Lords, and he used that as a convenient phrase to be persuasive, say the Lords have to listen to us because it's the will of the British people. Now, based on polling, the will of the British people is that an election should be had pretty soon. Should politicians act and make big decisions based on the latest polling, or should they stick to what they think and persuade people?
That is a good question, because I think in the case of Keir Starmer, who started his leadership relatively well and then seemed to have just fallen under the chaos of the COVID lockdowns and supporting this, opposing that, and being seen by voters as, you know, being a bit understood, quite flip-floppy over it. Boris Johnson did hit on something there that voters did see. If you follow opinion polling, you would have supported Iraq on day one and you would have opposed it 30 days later. You would have demanded a pullout 30 days later. Voters want to be led. They want to be led. They have their sentiments. They base it off 2-minute consumption of the news every evening. You can't use them to justify public policy. You've got to take long-term decision-making. And I think, should you listen to opinion polls? Yes, to get the lay of the land, to nurture your messaging, to nurture how you say, what you need to say to voters. But to change gear on policy straight away, I don't think so. Sunak uses Will of the People in relation to boats because he thinks, and with some relative decent reasoning, because the Brexit mandate that they all like to talk about is an overwhelming mandate for controls and immigration, taking back control, etc. Because Britons, by and large, want more restrictions to fewer. Okay, I get that. I can see why you would say Will of the People, but I think the Will of the People is, as you say, yes, a general election sooner. And you have other priorities, mate. Please sort those out instead. I think this is the thing. Will of the People seems like an excessive oversell on a sentiment that already exists. People do want boats sorted out. People do want refugees being properly processed once you take the emotion out of it. But there are other issues. And it's like a dramatic overreaction, I think, on Sunak's part there. If you want to get onto the history, I think where it started was actually Richard Nixon. It was he came on a pledge to end the war in Vietnam, and there were protests against him quite very much straight away, wasn't there, I think. And it was he who went on national television to say, do not be spoken for by the silent minority. And it was he that started this campaign of getting tens of thousands of letters in. So it's that sort of stuff. There's a time and a place to use it. And I think in our era of politics, of the 24/7 news life, we overuse it. There's a time and a place to invoke the people, not all the time, because we get tired of it. We get overused to it. We get exhausted from it and we stop listening. And I think by and large, voters have stopped listening to the Prime Minister, which is why everything he does doesn't work anymore.
So there we go. Super interesting conversation there with Ben. Thank you to Ben Walker of Britain Elects. Thank you to James O'Malley of James O'Malley. Thank you to our friends Ben Lovell and Emmy Files, and to our producer, Adrian Bradley. That has been What's Happening Now with Political Polling. See you soon.